Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1079.1CH2613, certificate number 23611. Rock, paper, scissors.
One throw! This is it! Nice and clean! Engage!
What do you think the most consequential decision that you've ever made is based on a coin toss, or that you ever made based on a coin toss is?
Like, does that have to be a literal coin toss? I feel like I've made lots of decisions just kind of that were as well thought out as a coin toss.
Like,
I don't think I've ever actually been like, I don't care.
Flip a coin?
Yeah, I don't care. Let's flip a coin.
What do you think that, like, in a Utah context, that would be considered gambling?
That's why.
Yeah.
Flipping a coin is sinful. Like Jesus said, render unto Caesar this coin. Don't flip it.
Right.
Remember when he says stuff like that?
I do remember. You know, the coin tossing in Caesar's time was actually called head or ship.
Because the ship was on the back of the coin?
Yeah. It wasn't, there was no tails. It was a ship, head or ship.
We should do that today. Just adapt it to the coin. Just look at what you got. Okay, we're going to do, you got a quarter. Head or eagle.
Yeah.
Wheat or Lincoln Memorial. Wait, what's on the penny nowadays? I don't even
know. Isn't it the Lincoln Memorial still? Oh, God, we sound so like old now.
Well, the penny doesn't even exist, right?
It still exists, but it's no longer being manufactured, I guess, starting soon.
Sorry, Big Zinc.
Sorry, Big Zinc.
Are you saying you literally have made decisions like, I don't know, let's flip a coin and see?
No, I also don't typically flip an actual coin, but we do the Freudian one. Freud actually talked about flipping coins as a way of searching your feelings. Search your feelings.
Isn't that the opposite of what you don't you flip a coin to avoid thinking about your priors and feelings?
Well, he did the like flip a coin, and then if the result of the coin toss is you go like right on, then you know that's what you wanted. And if you're like, oh, then he said specifically like don't follow the coin toss, just use the coin toss to decide how you feel about it. And we do that quite a bit here when you're like, should we get Thai food or Indian food? and we do like, okay, random Thai food. And if everybody's like,
it was wrong.
You go, okay, well, Indian food then. And the problem, of course, is then we go about Indian. And you're like, all right.
I'm well, even at the point where I'm suspicious of my own preference. I'm like, well, yeah, but if I say Thai food every time, then I'm just going to get Thai food every time. Maybe there's some virtue in saying some other thing that I feel like less. In fact, maybe it's good for me to get the food that's like my plan C. I don't know. I don't know anymore.
I try to always order something different at a restaurant. And the other night we were at a restaurant where I'm searching the menu and I feel like I've gotten everything. We've been to this restaurant a lot. It was my daughter's birthday. It's where she wanted to go. I'd gotten everything on this menu except for this one dish that was basically artichoke hearts and onions. And
I'm trying to think what cuisine this place is. Marlos Ur, your daughter's favorite Albanian place.
Yeah, exactly. And I said, you know, I'll have the whatever, artichokes and onions. And my sister was like, you know, this like order a different thing every time can go too far. And then my daughter chimed in and she was like, I think that he is disappointed at least half the time. And I said, no, it's never more than a quarter of the time.
You'd be disappointed if you got your favorite thing every time, I think.
That's the thing. You can't get Alfredo at an Italian restaurant every time. Bad for you.
I was reading a letter from an omnibus listener, because in the Oracle of Delphi entry that we recently put into the vault, we were talking about this, like how decision-making is essentially, you know, some magical process that goes on below the surface of the conscious mind, and who knows if it works or not. And we were talking about, in particular, the paralysis of choice that comes with trying to buy plane tickets.
Yeah.
Because you're like, well, this one's cheaper, but it's at 8 a.m. And,
yeah,
you know,
it's a middle seat.
I don't know. I don't have good miles on that airline. 20 different axes to stew about. And this reader was like, well, in the U.S., by law, you now have 24 hours to get a full refund after you buy a ticket. So I just buy the ticket that seems best. And then the next day I look and I'm like, do I want that ticket? It's the Thai food thing.
Well, that's not bad.
And he's like, and what I find is I nearly never change. Like the paralysis of choice was an illusion. I would have been equally happy or unhappy with any ticket in this inconsequential decision.
Yeah. Somebody posted the other day, one of these choices, mindless choice, where there were two tickets. They were $40 different in price. They were 10 minutes different in time. It's just one went through Denver and one went through Atlanta. And they were like, what do I do? And people were weighing in on it. It's like, I mean, this is like down to the wire.
But that is my life.
Yeah.
Sometimes I find that two people actually helps. Because I'll go to Mindy and be like, hey, one of these goes through Denver and one of these goes through Salt Lake or whatever it is. And she'll be like, I don't care. Or she knows I'll go away if she just says something.
Yeah, right.
Denver. And I'm like, oh boy, we did it.
Good work, team.
Second person solved the problem. You'd think it would be more complicated to have a democracy, but no, it helps.
Well, Mindy's more decisive, right? I mean, she's certainly more decisive than I am.
I think so. And often we'll collaborate. Okay, I'll narrow it down to three restaurants. You pick one of the three.
Yeah.
Or that stuff works.
I do feel that in the Northwest, we have a reputation, and I think deserved reputation, of being an indecisive. You know, we're not. I think of people from Philadelphia, or
they're impulsive.
Or just like, ah, what are you talking about? Do it.
Yeah. If I see Santa, I'm going to throw snowballs at it.
Exactly. And we're like, oh, I don't know. But what about it? What if the opposite? Well, what if this third opposite? And you're like, why? Why do we live like this?
We're in our feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
But I can't imagine using any of these. Like, I've literally never sat at a restaurant and thought, I don't know if I want this omelet or that omelet. I'm going to get out a coin. This will be fun. Like, it's just not part of my, life. I don't operate that way. Maybe I should. I don't know. I'm so indecisive. Should I do this?
I know.
Let me flip a coin to decide if I should become a coin flippy guy.
This is an ancient problem of trying to decide situations where different options are essentially equal. If you've got a situation where you've got four sailors and one of them has to work the tiller, and all four of them are basically equally capable, typically what people do is draw lots. They break one straw, pick of the four straws, the person that's holding the straws kind of makes him look like, oh, this one's taller. Ooh, is he playing a game or is that one of the taller ones?
Have you ever seen this happen in real life? This is something I only know of from movies.
Oh, I've drawn lots, yeah. Or you've drawn straws? Yeah. Yeah.
That one takes more prep than, you know, everybody has a coin in their pocket or a fist to shape into a rock or a paper or a scissors.
I mean,
you have to prepare and cut sticks or something to do this one.
It was much more common back when sort of I and everybody I knew had a matchbook in our pockets.
Right.
Because you can pull out four matches and make one, or, you know, like a box of matches especially is good for it because the little heads, you know, stick up above, but one of them's been snapped. And there's something, you know, there's something like that feels fateful about it. Like it imparts a kind of like ancient significance to what would be a mundane decision. Like you work the till and the rest of us will row or we'll switch off. But, you know, but I think in ancient times this was used for, I think even now, used for maybe more significant decisions. I don't think anybody like gets sacrificed to a volcano anymore based on drawing the short straw. But that's how you see it in movies, right? One of us has to die.
The lifeboat only fits three, right? Or, you know.
Somebody's got to go in and plug the reactor and they're not going to make it out. We're going to seal the door. So
I think you see it in movies because it's a more dramatic, slow reveal than, you know, a coin flip. It would be anticlimactic in a movie. Can you imagine three astronauts doing rock, paper, scissors in a movie to see who's going to go out the airlock? tie. Okay, it's Jerry.
Well, and it's a good opportunity too, for a movie to subvert your expectations where they go through the whole coin toss and then one guy is already in, you know, has already gone through the door, and it's like, wait a minute, how did he, oh no, what a hero.
Yeah, I almost think if you see a movie where there's a random choice, like it will be subverted by someone's will. Because nobody likes the idea that they're watching a movie that's been left to chance.
Yeah, right. Well, and every dramatic opportunity you get to make the movie 1 minute longer with everybody sweating.
Well, sure. It's just like, will this be a character beat or will this be a whim of fate? And any writer will prefer a character beat.
It actually still, this type of decision plays into contemporary culture in weird ways that you maybe wouldn't expect. Like, for instance, not this isn't necessarily contemporary, but do you know why the city of Portland is named Portland?
Oh, yeah. That's a coin flip, right? Yeah. It was going to be Boston.
Yeah. There were two guys, Asa Lovejoy and Francis Pettigrove.
Those are some good 19th century names,
right?
Right there.
We're talking about mid-1800s.
Those people are tradesmen in Laura Ingalls Wilder's town.
And they had basically cleared some land there along the Willamette, and the area was called The Clearing for a long time. Like, meet me at The Clearing, or I'm building my house on the outskirts of The Clearing. And when they realized that it was going to become a town and it couldn't be called The Clearing, the choice was between...
We want to sell donuts to stoners here. We don't want it to be called The Clearing.
It actually, you know, it's not a clearing anymore, but that is maybe a more appropriate name.
I can't believe there's not a venue there called The Clearing.
Oh, my God.
Is it not a club?
That'd be an awesome... Yeah, they serve... Yeah, exactly. Bacon, donuts, and hash, and really good coffee.
Your band never got to play The Clearing.
No, we didn't. The Blackbird, we played. All the Portland venues. The thing is, that was before venues and restaurants started being named things like the Iron and the Coconut.
Right.
Or the, you know, the Lizard and the Top Hat.
They all just had their old 19th century... What was the ballroom in Portland? The... Crystal Ballroom.
Right. Played there a million times.
It's now a McMenamins. That's depressing.
Oh, McMenamins owns everything.
They own Oregon.
But so they flipped this coin, this like copper penny. It's not even, Portland isn't even named Portland because they flipped a silver dollar. They flipped, because these days, of course, if you're going to flip a coin, you find the biggest coin.
Right.
You don't flip a penny. Somebody digs around in their pockets, or at least until recently, and pulls out whatever big coin they have. Now, I think a lot of coin tosses that are ceremonial actually have ceremonial coins, like all the NFL games.
Because then they can sell it later.
Yeah,
that's the only reason.
Yeah, they send it to the Baseball Hall of Fame, and then they sell it in the tourist shop.
I was watching live whatever that game was in the 90s where the coin toss went awry. Do you know how now in the NFL you have to call the coin toss before the referee flips it?
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And it's because, so the referee, you say tails, referee's like, tails? Yeah, okay. Because there was some game where the referee was like, he flips and he's like, okay, tails. And the guy's like, no, I didn't say tails, I said heads. And it turned into like three guys squabbling about, no, you didn't. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. This is all on live TV. Al Michaels is like, what's happening?
What's funny is statistically, of course, this is a thing that has been done by scientists a thousand times because you got to keep your funding. And who knows if it's ever going to, I mean, who knows if this is the thing that's going to keep the aliens from destroying the Earth. But yeah, they've flipped a coin 50,000 times and determined that there was a tiny statistical preference for the coin to land the same way up as it was up before it was flipped.
Oh, I thought it was going to be relative to the different engraving, you know, the side that has more weight or whatever. No, it's just relative to...
If you flip it heads up, there is a 50.1% chance that it's going to land heads up.
I bet the gap is narrower, right? It's like 50.0001.
And then a different group of scientists did the same, and it was like, no, it depends on whether it's a tall person or a short person, whether it's a girl or a boy.
It just means their little robot, spring-loaded robot thumb wasn't... calibrated right.
Although apparently magicians, like in everything, magicians can figure out how to do it where they really improve the statistics.
Yeah.
And you can
force a coin flip.
You can. I mean, if it's just like cards, like how the hell do you just have to do it 1,000 times and you get so you can do it dependably.
I never have coins anymore, but maybe I should just start carrying around a deck of cards. Not because I'm a close-up magic weirdo, but just I'd be like, all right, high card goes, and I bring out my deck of cards.
I would love that, but the problem is if you're carrying a deck of cards, the assumption is you're a close-up magic weirdo.
Right, or that you're cheating in some way. Why does this guy have a deck of cards, and why is he proposing this weird alternative to a coin flip?
The thing is, and I don't mean this to be insulting, I mean this as a compliment, you very much have the vibe of somebody that might secretly be good at card tricks.
That is a compliment.
Yeah.
I wish I had that kind of manual dexterity. I would actually love that.
Me too.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I believe.
Thank
I
you
believe.
For validating my magician adjacency.
Yeah, you are, you know, a weirdo.
You're giving close-up magic.
Close-up magic. I mean, I could also see myself being expected to be able to pull a coin from behind a child's ear,
mm-hmm.
and I can't do any of that. I can't even remember jokes. Somebody's like, tell a joke. You're a funny guy. I'm like, I don't, you know. I remember a couple of like Dada jokes.
Yeah, like
jokes
anti-jokes.
Yeah, anti-jokes. But that's not funny. Nobody likes that.
You can always just steal someone's nose.
Yeah, that's a good.
Can't go wrong.
Steal their nose.
Can't go wrong, grandpa trick.
In addition to like coin flips as a kind of whatever, like, maybe minor decision maker, they still play a role in politics because there are, I guess, in politics, more consequential ties than there are in most other situations. You can resolve most problems where the consequences are fairly high by other means, but in politics, more often than you would expect, get a situation where it's just a tie. There were the same number of votes.
We did a whole entry on election ties.
Yeah.
And I remember that in many cases, the last tiebreaker is, and then there's a coin flip.
A coin flip, right.
And people have served in office because of a coin flip, right?
In 2017, in the Virginia House of Delegates, both candidates, David Yancey and Shelley Simmons, got 11,608 votes. Did we talk about this on the election tie?
It would have been after 2017,
yeah.
So it's possible.
Anyway, they had to, a coin toss was possible, but they ended up both putting their names in a hat, essentially.
Oh, yeah, names in a hat.
And Yancey won, and in doing so, gave the Republicans in the Virginia House of Delegates a one-person majority, and it had serious consequences.
State policy was changed by this hat. Once again, Democrats, feckless and useless, and can't even win a hat drawing.
If the Democrats had won, if Shelley Simmons had won, it would have been a 50-50 tie in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, even if the Democrats won, they lost.
Your vote counts.
But this happened in 2021 in the Yukon territories, where
one vote each for.
Yeah, what's hilarious is 11,000 votes get you in the Virginia House of Delegates, but like I ran for the Seattle City Council and got, I don't know how many votes. I don't remember it anymore. I probably exaggerate it, but it was way more than 11,000. Right. It's like 40,000 votes, and I came in third.
You could be in the Virginia legislature four times.
I know. Well, but anyway, so this is not a small, it's not an inconsequential part of human society. There have been, there's been the need to resolve these kind of close, like razor-thin margin situations since ancient times.
The need to randomize.
The need to randomize. And of course, because all civilization, every time we talk about Western civilization, there's always some voice that comes in from the left and they're like, but China! And you're like, yeah, I know. China had an advanced civilization 3,000 years before the first European put on a hat.
Should we add this to our intro, just some recorded voice that says, China probably invented this first?
Exactly. In every situation. Yep.
And it would be weird for some of them. Like, maybe we shouldn't do it before the golden age of porn show. But they did.
Yeah, sure.
They absolutely did.
Absolutely. Think about all the great Chinese porn that's carved into rocks.
They probably had an Indian 1,500-year porn edge on us. But we caught up.
I mean, anytime you say, I'll have the Alfredo, somebody at the table's like, you know, pasta came from China. You're like, stop it. I'm not arguing that it didn't.
I didn't say it didn't.
I'm not even sure if Alfredo came from China. I don't think it did. They don't use a lot of cream sauce.
Not a lot of Chinese guys named Alfredo.
Right.
But we could change that. Alfredo Lim, if you're listening, please let us know.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
But in China, there was, it's not attributed until the Ming Dynasty, but a writer during the Ming Dynasty says that the kind of precursor to Rochambeau, rock, paper, scissors, dates back to the Han Dynasty, which is, as we all know, 300 AD. I don't think they used that calendar in the Han Dynasty.
That would be weird. But if this guy in the Ming Dynasty is right, rock, paper, scissors, light games are almost 2,000 years old.
Yeah, and you can kind of see how it naturally evolves. Rock, paper, scissors is good in a two-person situation. You can also have a third.
You just have to wait. You have to keep reshooting until there's a clear winner, or do you ever narrow down? I guess you narrow down, right?
Yeah, you narrow down.
If there's two papers and a rock, the single rock goes.
The single rock goes.
You only have to repeat if there's if all three symbols are up, you can't resolve that.
Exactly. Right. More than one way to have a tie. But in ancient China, the game was called Frog, Slug, Snake.
Frog, Slug, Snake.
Yeah. And it was played with fingers. The thumb was the frog, the pinky was the slug, and the index finger was the snake.
That kind of works. The snake's longer than the other two, and right. the frog is fatter than the other two.
The frog is fatter. I think the Chinese thought that the Chinese word for venomous centipede is the same or close enough to slug. The Japanese word for slug, that when it got translated into Japanese, it became slug instead of venomous centipede.
So it may have started out as
frog, snake, venomous centipede.
Do the Chinese have poisonous frogs? Are they naming three dangerous animals? I don't know.
I think a frog eats venomous centipedes, and everybody would know that.
Of course.
Right? Like, oh, sure, the frog.
As every child knows. Yeah. It's the main thing about frogs.
But the dangerous centipede can kill a snake.
With its bite.
Apparently. And I'm not sure how a slug kills a snake.
Yeah, it doesn't work when you turn it into a slug.
But, you know.
The main thing is you pick three things that circle. If you're just picking three random animals, Japan, pick a different animal.
Well, so Japan, so this emigrates to Japan, I think, different times over the course of the multi-thousand year relationship between China and Japan. At one point, it is like thumb, pinky, index finger, it's like frog, slug, snake, and then it becomes fox versus sort of chief of the village versus hunter.
Hold on. So what's the order? The hunter gets the fox.
No, if the hunter gets the fox gets the chief, because in Japanese culture, foxes are mythical, magical.
A kitsune or something.
Yeah, they do cool tricks.
So he outranks
tricks.
Even the village chief, but then the chief outranks the hunter?
Yeah, the chief can bust the hunter, but the hunter can kill the fox.
You do need one kind of paradoxical thing, because it can't just be stronger, stronger, stronger. It's got to come back around like an Escher waterfall.
And that's called an intransitive game, because there's no, in a transitive game, like there's a winner who beats.
Yeah. If A is better than B and B is better than C, then A is also better than C.
Better than C, right. But intransitive games have that circular. It actually appears in nature. There's a kind of like lizard where when male lizards are trying to choose, or a female lizard is trying to choose a mate, there are lizards with like yellow neck puffs, blue or green neck puffs.
I see.
And red neck puffs.
She's got a choice to make.
Yeah, but and yellow is better than green, but green is better than red, but red is better than yellow.
So we actually know that this is her preference by studying this in a lab, but we don't understand why she thinks this.
Yeah, right. And it happens at the bacterial level too. There are these kind of intransitive decision making things that are preconscious, right? It's not no one's making a decision at the level of a paramecium. And yet there is this kind of cyclical preference.
You have to wonder if it's like the basis for all life somehow.
Right. It's just another instance of weird fractal dice rolling.
Without this strange loop, no life evolves somehow.
Apparently God does roll dice. He does pick lots.
But the dice is circular. It's not just 1 to 6. Somehow also 1 is better than 6.
Right. Throws 3 dice. But in its final version of rock, paper, scissors, it was, again, sort of an import into Japan from China, and using the, you know, fist, the scissors shape, and the paper, or cloth.
Yeah, it's cloth in Korean.
It's cloth in Korean.
I just remembered.
And Korea goes whole hog on this game.
Oh,
there's,
is that right?
30 iterations of it in Korea.
Even growing up there, like, people would know, like, there'd be like fast, it wouldn't just be decision making, it would just be like a fast paced, pass the time game based on, In Korean, it's great because scissors and rock rhyme. Kawi, bawi, bo. So, you know, you say it really fast and it's like, kai bai bo, kai bai bo, kai bai bo, which is very propulsive. And
right,
fun.
And there is, in the Korean use of this game, there's a lot of chanting and there's a lot of, like, you play it with multiple people where you keep going until there's a, what is it? You keep going until there's a tie, like winner, loser, keep going until there's a tie. And at the tie, the last person to win is the winner.
Mm.
So that's how you do like 2 out of 3.
Well, that makes sense.
You just keep going until you hit a tie. But everybody is saying the, you know, the words for it. I mean, I had it written down as Mook Gigi Papa. But that's my Korean. That's my pronunciation.
It's not actually close to the game I've
probably
seen.
Probably not at all. But, you know, but the same thing, it means it's some kind of like calling out of the signs.
I've seen a version of the game where you just keep, you don't have to do the bup, bup. I mean, you can do the bup, 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 bup,
boom,
bup,
boom, boom.
But yeah, you can also do bup, 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 shoot, shoot, shoot. You can keep changing the symbol to get to some, if you know, some variant of the game.
Well, here's a question for you. When you do it, do you go 1, 2, shoot on the final, or do you do 1, 2, 3, shoot?
I grew up 1, 2, shoot. But that just could be, maybe that's the Korean kai bai bo, because bo doesn't rhyme with the other two. It's, that becomes shoot. You're saying scissors, rock, cloth, scissors, rock, cloth, scissors, rock, cloth, and bo becomes the shoot. But I feel like the 1, 2, 3 shoot is more common now.
1, 2, 3, boom.
Is that what you saw American kids doing?
I think so. But I feel like I've played it both ways. It might just be a thing you establish at the top of the game. But yeah, when I was a kid, 1, 2, 3, pow. Yeah, right, it's 3 times.
Well, that's a comedy beat in a lot of movies. The person who thinks we're going to go 1, 2, 3 instead of 1, 2, 3, go. You don't go on 3. You got to go 1, 2, 3, go. This is probably in half the movies John C. Reilly has ever made.
Yeah, that's right. Janine Garofalo, I can see her doing it.
Janine Garofalo, wow. So it's the same thing, you know, but I don't know. Yeah, what's more common now? I don't know. Do the kids still do rock,
I think,
paper,
they
scissors?
Do. I think they do. In fact, I think that it's generally understood that rock, paper, scissors is part of childhood development now. That, you know, where you not only learn the game, but you learn that level of, you learn in transitivity. Mm. It's part of, it's part of development. Although it's not a game, it's not a Western game. This is entirely... All research into where it came from goes back to China through Japan.
So how did it come to the U.S.?
Well, if you think about like the opening of Japan, Admiral Perry goes to Japan in the 1850s after centuries of Japan being closed to the West. He kind of forces his gunboat diplomacies his way.
Puts his big American foot in the door.
That's right. It says, listen, we are getting pots from you. Because there had always been a way to get, there was always one place that the West could trade with Japan. They actually had a little island.
Right. They were like, you can have Nagasaki. We'll have some Portuguese there. Yeah. We're not happy about it. But
the Dutch will come and they can get like 2 boats a year or whatever. And so Japanese pottery, Japanese metalworking, these things were available in the West at great expense.
Scarce and valuable.
Yeah. And so kind of when Perry went in, he did it because this was, that they made treasures there. And by the 1870s, you know, Japonism, was having a huge influence on Western art.
Right.
In France and whatnot, the enamel, metalworking, the pottery.
The Impressionists loved it.
Loved it. Yeah. And so when looking for like a gateway into the West for a game like rock, paper, scissors, my sort of guess is that it came as a result of that, like, the interest in the Orientalism, the excitement about everything Japanese.
Let's learn a Japanese game, kids. So it was, you don't think it was, for example, Chinese workers in the American West?
No, it doesn't seem like it. Although, like if you think about the fetishizing of Japanese culture, like the Mikado came out in 1885.
Yeah.
Woodblock prints, obviously, in all of Impressionism and so forth.
And all the post-Impressionists who were like, I'm going to paint like that. It influences design. And
it doesn't first appear in the United States until the 1920s.
The game.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And at first, you know, it kind of came into the U.S. in a garbled way.
That kind of schoolyard stuff is always poorly documented.
Right.
Because who's going to write this down? You know, it's not like the Atlantic is ever going to be like, a new game has taken the elementary schools of San Francisco by storm.
Well, there were some articles like that. It first appeared, I think, in like children's novels.
Oh, see, that's what happens. Kids have been doing it for years, and then suddenly it happens to show up in some Tom Swift adventure novel.
Yeah, right. Like, oh, like Mary Jane played, you know, I mean, it wasn't always called Rochambeau. It was first kind of called John Kempo. And Poe does kind of seem more like Chinese.
Are they using the word for cloth there?
Yeah, I think maybe it was just a sort of garbled, like, oh, this sounds vaguely Japanese and vaguely Asian.
I don't think we heard Rochambeau. Did you grow up calling it Rochambeau?
When did I hear Rochambeau? I think so. I think it was called,
because it's better if it's all one syllable word. You don't want to be like rock, paper, scissors.
Right.
Rock, paper.
Rochambeau.
Even if you end with rock, it kind of sucks. Scissors, paper, rock. Scissors, paper, rock.
Yeah, I think Rochambeau was always something. And I do remember the culture clash of saying Rochambeau to someone and having them go, what's that? And saying rock, paper, scissors.
Our school calls it.
Yeah, why did you say Rochambeau?
Well, does Rochambeau refer to, isn't there some French guy, the Count de Rochambeau or something? Why would it have a French name?
So that's a reverse attribution? Thank you. A reverse attribution that has no one can understand. I mean, it was legendary that he used it as part of his decision making.
But that's clearly some post hoc.
Yeah,
bull.
Okay. He couldn't have known the game, or that's not where the name comes from. And there's some sense of like, oh, Rochambeau is close to what some early person might have heard when a Japanese person showed it to them.
If Americans are calling it John Kempo or Rochambeau, they must be mimicking
something,
the pattern that they were hearing.
But there was also an element of it, I think, early on where it did feel like sort of a gambling, like a Chinese gambling game.
Well, those have caught on. I mean,
a lot.
Americans love Mahjong.
I love Mahjong. But, you know, there was a little bit of like, is this a back alley game rather than a schoolyard game?
Well, I was going to ask you this because it's funny that this has become our default decision-making thing, the ultimate fairway, because it is not a game of chance. It's a game of skill, right?
Well, so the skill involved is largely about cheating in the sense that you're watching most successful people that game it are watching the other person's hand to see if it begins a motion.
And then you can quickly
move, you know,
to the beating
if
one.
You're moving your scissors hands or you're twisting your fist, like they have invented a robot that can win 100% of the time because it can detect within milliseconds as the hand starts to move.
And it can probably form its shape faster than any human fist could, right?
Exactly. And you can do pretty well kind of watching the other person and just let them lead you by a heartbeat and then move your hand in response to what you see.
But couldn't a blindfolded person also win more than 33% of the time, or in a two-person game, 50% of the time?
So
it's just by going on
the statistics of it are that a sizable majority of the first choices is, what would you guess?
I feel like I've looked at this. I think, isn't, what's the right play? Maybe paper? What's the right play? Do people tend to play rock more than things?
35% of the first throw is a rock. And I think it's more men throw rock. and more women tend to throw scissors.
Toxic masculinity,
I know.
Once again.
And I think there's also a pretty significant, like, statistical evidence that people are going to throw the same thing the second time. So if you throw rock and it wins, you're going to throw rock again. Assuming that the next person's going to figure you're going to throw paper and keep throwing scissors or whatever.
So even if you're not trying any late-changing cheating, you can still kind of dynamically play somebody and keep, have a sense in mind of what the probabilities are each time as they shift.
So for instance, if you're playing a guy, you're even though only 29% of people throw paper, paper is going to statistically win more often as a first throw because you're going to get rock more often than you're going to get scissors.
Yeah, and especially if scissors is the least thrown.
Right.
So that you're safe. Paper will at least be a tie.
But if you know that and you feel like the other person is savvy, you're going to throw scissors and this is kind of, you know, this is, well,
you're playing
the game.
You're playing some game theory recursion where you're like, is this guy going to go another level deep?
Right.
So and I wonder if there are people who are good at that level. Like, I'm intuitively, empathically good at reading people, or this is someone I know well.
So though scissors is the least thrown, only 26% are scissors, it's the strategic, it's the smart move if everybody knows to expect the dumb guy to throw rock.
Hmm.
Because... Or rather, if everybody there is smart enough to know to that know the dumb guy throws rock.
To know the rock, right.
Right.
But unless everybody goes one level deeper, you know, well, if everyone's going to do the scissors thing, then I can get around that by indeed throwing rock.
Ha-ha!
Trusty rock.
And that's what's so fun about the game and why it actually sort of maintains a... It has become a fascination because it's a way... people have designed algorithms around it, and it's become very popular in gamer culture, and because of its prominence in Japanese culture and thinking, you see it a lot in video games. A lot of Japanese video games have some sort of rock, paper, scissor, some sort of intransitive frog, slug,
I see,
snake sort of choice. It plays in Pokemon. Right? There are Pokemons that defeat other Pokemons that defeat other Pokemons, and it recurses.
Well, it creates a level playing field, right? Like, a lot of games would not benefit by having some super good, you know, if Bowser is always the best at Mario Kart, everyone just picks Bowser. You know, the game breaks.
Right. And you get it in sort of D&D situations or, you know, magic beats bows and arrows beats knives, but knives beat magic.
They do.
Yeah, you can come up and
steal is.
You can stab a magician.
I mean, I'd love to stab a magician.
You can't stab an archer because he's got you from a long way off, and an archer can't get a bow or an arrow off on a magician because he's.
Is the idea that you can stab quicker than the wizard can mutter?
Yeah,
can incant
while the wizard's busy fighting the archer. You sneak in and stab the wizard.
Or he's stirring his reagents.
Look, I don't want to give away Dungeons & Dragons. You're going to have to fight these battles according to the dice.
I didn't know Dungeons & Dragons had spoilers.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
Sorry, I ruined your campaign.
But also, like, swords are defeated by axes.
Okay.
Axes are defeated by lances, but lances are defeated by swords. Because a sword can chop the head off a lance.
I see, you don't have to... So some of these actually do parallel real combat. It's not just some construct in the game to make sure that everything's weighted right.
Yeah, right, right.
Maybe not the magic one. That's not based on actual spellcasting.
Well,
we don't
know. Yourself.
We don't know.
Speak for yourself as a certified half-elf magic
user. You go
user.
Around knifing Wiccans
well,
in diners?
No, I don't have to knife them. They're trying to, you know, they're trying to... No, I'm the magic user in this story.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
Not Wiccans. You've seen me do little conjuring. No card tricks, of
I've
course,
seen you carving little pentagrams in your Trapper Keeper.
I'm not a Satanist. Have we... Wait a minute. Have we done Anton LaVey?
We haven't.
Boy, that seems like an omnibus.
We've chatted about him before.
Yeah.
Should we pivot right now?
You know what?
Here we go. Anton LaVey.
I've also done a lot of research on Anton LaVey.
China may have invented Anton LaVey before the West.
You actually see You actually see a Korean iteration of it in the television show Squid Game. Did you watch that?
I did.
It's very violent.
It is.
But they play a two-handed version. The two-handed version is really interesting because you throw two hands, and then each player gets to take away one of the hands and leave one standing. So it does give you the option.
And do you have to also remove simultaneously?
Well, I think let's play two-handed. Rochambeau.
I don't even know if I'm coordinated enough to do.
So you've got two-handed. Scissors and paper. So you take away one.
I'm going to take away the one that lost and then, and keep the one
and
that
then
won.
I lose because I had two fists.
Yeah.
But then we do it again. Oh, Shambo. What did you get?
It doesn't matter which side is which, or does it?
You have to choose one.
But does my left match up with your right facing? Like, is my paper in a duel with your scissors right now?
I don't know, because if you took away paper to crush my scissors, then
because if these line up, you have beaten my two.
So I guess that's a tie. Mm. And on and on. I mean, I didn't watch Squid Game all the way through because, I don't know, by the last two episodes, my daughter's mother/partner
bailed.
Got bored and wanted to watch a cowboy show or something.
It's a very melancholy ending.
Or a show with a strong female lead.
Thank you, finally.
Yeah.
About time, someone said it.
Now, every time she's like, oh, we're watching this show, and it comes up, and I'm like, DEI, DEI! Because it's a strong female lead. Because, you know, Trump's America, right? I'm trying to conform. We've eliminated all of our DEI programs here at Omnibus.
Just two white men left. Finally, a podcast with two white men.
Two white men!
I love the idea that they're pulling, like, Colin Powell off the DOD website. Like,
can you imagine that?
An undistinguished soldier like Pete Hegseth is like, what works is if mediocre white men do not have to be challenged by talented people who are not mediocre white men.
They took Code Talkers off. Code Talkers. Like a whole...
They took Jackie Robinson down.
Like the greatest sort of military coup. It's such a great story. Like, oh, they speak their native languages that we tried to eradicate. And now we found a use case for them. And they're like, DEI.
And a patriotic use
case.
Yeah,
right. DEI.
It really is a tacit admission that... like the only way mediocre white men compete is if you get rid of Jackie Robinson and Code Talkers. Like once you forget actual history, then mediocre white men look very good.
What's crazy is just the blatantness of, well, anything involving people of color doing well is DEI. Right. Like it's so blatant. There's not even any kind of...
Wouldn't it be the opposite?
Mask of like...
Like if Jackie Robinson's doing great stuff in the 40s before DEI is a thought technology, isn't that a... sign that it wasn't DEI?
You know what? It should all be down to Rochambeau.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
We didn't actually... The New York Times did a story on a reporter went to Japan to talk about congestion in write an article about congestion in Japanese traffic.
Okay.
It was already really crowded in 1932. And in that article, they describe rock, paper, scissors as a game, and they do it in a way that suggests the audience would not have heard of it. So its introduction to the U.S. came within my father's lifetime. We think of it as an ancient game, and it is, but we had no exposure to it prior. Like in World War I, They still would have been breaking matchsticks to resolve issues.
And when's, this article is in the 30s, basically?
In the 30s,
so yeah. The very first earliest adopters are going to be, you know, probably Greatest Generation if they were kids then, you know? Like,
right.
The first kids Flappers. To play would have been the... Yeah, but if you're a kid playing, you're actually... You're going to grow up and fight in World War II, you know?
Yeah. And these were, yeah, I mean, I obviously they would be most people's grandparents. Did your grandparent or your granddad fight in World War II?
Yes.
But in my case, my dad, because as we all know, I'm a boomer, effectively. Boomer.
honorary boomer. I requested a 70-year-old father so I could be a little more of a boomer.
I feel like rock, paper, scissors played a not insignificant role in my childhood.
We used it all the time.
All the time.
Because on the playground, there's many use cases. You can just do it for fun, or it's like, well, which team goes first? Or
right.
which team is she on? Or are we going to play this game or that game?
And we didn't, I guess maybe because as children, they didn't give us coins because we would take them and immediately spend them on candy. We'd go get a nickel candy.
Buy a peppermint stick.
Yeah, we'd ride our little homemade scooter down to the candy store and get a 5-cent bag of candy.
You are a boomer or possibly a pioneer child.
I feel like I was looking at this the other day. My father's generation, my father's family, I'm only 5 generations removed from the Revolutionary War. Whereas in my mother's family, I'm 7 generations away from the Revolutionary War. Like in just that short amount of time, my dad's family, because they had children so late in life.
Well, often it just takes one person to mess it up.
Yeah.
You know, one guy on his second wife has a kid in his mid-70s.
Then you just skipped 2 generations.
Yeah.
So I do have a lot of Victoriana in just the, as you can see around here. I mean,
Yeah, all your anti-macassars and
hair
oils.
A Prussian military uniform and a stand like right leering over
there
your shoulder.
There literally is.
Yeah.
I can see it with my peripheral vision.
But rock, paper, scissors still, you know, it's kind of, it comes back into the internet. Like you would think the internet would have a 1,000 ways to resolve after you have like a calculator watch, there's a million ways that you can randomize decision making. You can do this type of thing.
I do remember learning the random number command on my Apple II in the early 80s.
What, do you still remember it?
Well, I mean, it was a DOS command, I don't know, RND or something, and it would produce a random number. And it did not, I suddenly had this moment of being like, wait, how does a deterministic computer pick a random number? And it was just it blew my 9-year-old mind. Do you know how it works?
No.
It has to be seeded by something
right.
that actually is random, which is typically some user input, you know, the gap in milliseconds between the last 2 key presses or something. A computer will remember that.
Oh.
And then manipulate that amount in different ways. Add up the digits and divide by something. Add up the digits, divide, you know, whatever it does.
But there has to be an input.
Yeah, it can't actually start, a computer can't decide because all its circuits are in a certain setting. And it can't suddenly do anything that would equally produce 17 and 108.
Interesting.
Not really.
Well, I mean, I was just in Las Vegas and there are so many games there now that originally were mechanical. And now are just strictly digital.
And could totally be cheating.
Absolutely.
Like video poker? Who knows?
The idea that I would sit down at a game and feed money into a thing that's like, oh, you lost. Like, wait a minute.
You decided to make the 7 come up instead of the lemon. Come on.
And in the city of Las Vegas, there are a lot of laws about how often the games have to pay. And obviously, it favors the house, but you can't have your games so that they...
But it does seem like maybe the laws are not encouraging randomness. They're just encouraging a certain outcome, which means the games can cheat things like you seem so close to winning.
And that's what they do.
Because you're not getting actual random results like you would have on a mechanical slot machine. You're getting a result that will make you psychologically play again.
That's, I think, exactly what it is. Oh, I mean, man. I'm not sure. I'm not going to, if you work for the Las Vegas Gaming Council, like maybe you should write in and we'll talk about your letter on
anonymously.
We'll talk about your letter anonymously on our addenda show.
Send us 5 bullet points of things you accomplished this week and mm-hmm. let us know how the slot machines work.
But all the games in Las Vegas feel... I always avoid those games. And I was with somebody who said, I'm going to teach you how to play craps. Which feels like...
When you say avoid those games, you mean you avoid all casino games?
All casino games.
You're not like, I'll play blackjack for fun.
No, I don't find it fun. I think that I have a gambling nature. And from a young age, like when I was on drugs, I was like, I am never going to shoot up drugs because that feels like a gateway. The term gateway drug used for marijuana maybe is true, but for sure shooting up drugs is a gateway to not good outcomes. There's no like, oh, maybe I'll just become a casual user.
Casual heroin
user. Of these drugs. And I've always felt that way about gambling. There's something in my heart where I go, oh, don't open that door.
I actually am the opposite. I don't enjoy it, which means I can happily sit down at a blackjack table. And if I win 20 bucks, I'm like, great, I'm out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like.
Because of the cigarette smoke and the whole vibe is so unpleasant. I look for any excuse to stop gambling.
My sixth grade year, my school had some kind of swap meet where everybody in the school brought some junk from home and we had folding tables and you could, you know, buy people's junk. And I had some junk and sold it for $2. And I went over to a table where I saw a kid that had something cool and I bought it for $2. And then some other kid saw it and said, I'll give you $4 for that. And it ignited a fuse in me. And I spent the rest of
Yankee Trader.
I'm big time. I spent the rest of the afternoon just going from table to, and there were enough tables and enough kids that nobody really, you know, like grokked what I was up to until I had purchased a watch, like a Hamilton wristwatch.
Did you realize you're telling another pioneer child story? Did you know you're Tom Sawyer in this story?
But my eyes were huge because I had turned that $2 into whatever a Hamilton watch was worth at the time.
Until Aunt Polly finds out.
Yeah, that's right. And I get the switch.
That's right.
But I felt it in my heart like, oh, I could do this. I could do this, but I would never be satisfied because that Hamilton watch only represented the next biggest thing I could get. And the Hamilton watch was the nicest thing you could get. At this...
Well, you had the second order realization that most people do not have that level of self-awareness. Like, you were like, this is great, but you also had the thing of, and it has its limits.
I will never be happy. But I sat down at this craps table, and of course, I don't understand all that's going on. And the person I was with said, ignore 90% of what you see. Like, all of these different bets, they're all just people trying to lose money. Here's what you do. You bet on these two things, and then you double down on it, and you just do that. And we sat there, and I won like $150. And I said, it can't be this easy.
It's not.
And she said, well, you just, oh, this is, craps is the game you can win.
It's not 51%, though. Like, she probably gave you the tips that made it the closest to 50 you can get. The house still wins even if you do the smart thing at craps.
Yeah, beats me, but it was the first time I ever did a thing, and I won this money, and then she was like, let's get out of here. You know, you won $150.
Were you like, no.
Well, she won $150. Well, I didn't want to be there. I mean, I just could feel the hair standing up on me. Like, don't get this in my head that not only the gambling is fun, but the craps is some kind of thing you can know about.
I think we both kind of agree on this, that you should be scared of most fun things.
Yes, yes. Like, anytime.
Please do not be delighted by fun things. Let us be old stick in the muds and tell you, please be a little scared of things that are fun.
This is the thing about fast cars that I realized a long time ago, which is that if you get a fast car, if I get a fast car, I will drive the car to its limit. And at its limit, I am a danger to myself and others. But if you get a four-cylinder car with 50 horsepower and drive it at its limit, it's still really fun. Like the car's going, wah! And you feel like you're, because it's a little and it's low and it's rad. And so I've for a long time been like, do not fetishize high horsepower things. Don't try and go fast. I mean, try and go fast, but give yourself like,
create an environment where
yeah.
you can't actually make too much trouble.
You're going really fast and cars are just going by you right and left. Like, stay on the small road.
Is this a winning message for a podcast? Don't have too much fun, folks.
Right.
Whatever you do.
Right. Well, and definitely
nobody wants to hear that.
Don't try to get rich. Just try to, just try to cut it, right?
You got
to
know when to walk away and know when to run.
Know when to run. Did you ever get into BattleBots? Did you ever watch those robot wars on TV?
Yeah, I'm aware.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan. I had kids that went through BattleBots phases.
In the 90s, there was a group down in San Francisco called the Survival Research Laboratories. And they kind of invented that robots murdering each other thing. They had a warehouse that was kind of down in South San Francisco. And they built these robots that had flamethrowers and chainsaws, like legit dangerous. And it was not permitted, but it was at a time when, there were no laws in San Francisco.
Exactly.
And I went to a couple of these events and they were terrifying because the chainsaw robot would hit the flamethrower robot and pieces would fly off. And
some of them still on fire.
And we were just standing around in a wide circle, admittedly, but like, standing around it.
It's a fun place to go because you're like, I'm an extra in a Blade Runner movie.
Yeah, and there's smoke in the air and it's dark and it was pretty rad. But I think over time, the BattleBots settled into a sort of Rochambeau, what they call robot Darwinism.
Was this something people decided or is this a natural equilibrium that is reached by robots?
It naturally kind of happened that some people were building lifters with the idea that you'd go under your enemy robot and flip it on its head. And some developed spinners that would spin something real fast and crush, destroy the tracks or the wheels or whatever was powering the other robot. And then there were some that had no really moving parts. They were just wedge-shaped, and they could crash into spinners and destroy them. But the lifters could get under them and flip them.
Mm.
And so there was, this happened in BattleBots.
So
and
maybe this explains why it's in biological organisms. If systems evolve this way.
Well, and of course, nerd culture then fairly recently needed to deeply nerdify rock, paper, scissors. And they did it by introducing two more elements so that it became essentially a pentagram of intransitivity.
Is it still a circle or does it cross like a pentagram?
It crosses like a pentagram.
Oh, weird.
And it is called Rock, Paper, Scissors, Lizard, Spock.
Oh, I've heard of this.
And it became a plot point, or it was used in the television show featuring your good friend, Mayim.
Big Bang Theory?
Big Bang Theory. Apparently the Sheldon character.
But they didn't invent it. The writers of the show did not invent it. They just pulled it off a news group
or something.
Yeah,
it was invented by some other nerd.
They just pulled it off FARC or something.
But the idea of it is that the introduction of Spock and Lizard, Spock can smash Lizard and he can vaporize Rock.
So everybody loses to two things and beats two things.
Right. A Lizard can poison Spock.
Oh, no.
Paper disproves Spock.
Paper. Why are we assuming what's on the paper? Shouldn't Spock be able to his way around a paper?
The paper makes Spock look like an idiot.
Man, come on, Spock. Up your game.
The Lizard can eat paper,
yes,
which we know about.
That one, I believe.
But the Lizard is crushed by Rock, and it's decapitated by scissors, on and on and on. You can see like how Lizard and Spock being introduced into the game turns it into, I guess, a group activity.
And Spock lends itself to a throw. I assume it's the live long and prosper
thing. It is. And then Lizard is just like a hand puppet, like, I'm a lizard.
So they do have the advantage of having easy hand gestures.
It does feel like you could gamify it, though. If somebody's about to make the Spock symbol, you can't get there.
It's harder to. I don't know. I also can't do the Spock symbol with both hands. I can only do it with my right.
What, is that right?
Yeah. The weird thing is, I can do this with my. I can do the reverse of the Spock.
Oh, I
can't
with my
left.
Ow! Ow! Reverse Spock.
I've never seen research on why, why some people can do this and some people
that
can't.
Hurts.
There's got to be. Is it the kind of thing you can actually get better at?
Like, I bet
it is. I just need to get the right ligament loose enough, I could do it?
I've already got there, and I couldn't do it at first. Ugh. Oh.
Well, most people can go back and some people could go back and forth between the Spock thing and the inverse one.
Oh, that would break my brain.
But I can't.
Oh wow, I should keep working at that. Yeah, that might make me a better guitar player.
What if it's a gene? Like, what if you just have it or you don't? It's
a
chromosome.
You can see that I got there, so eventually.
Yeah, you're just lazy.
Ow. I've just never done it. Yeah. I didn't know it existed.
What is on the paper? What is on the paper that disproves Spock?
God, I love that you're like...
Well, it's just a very powerful paper.
Yeah. Spock...
As I understand Star Trek, like, Spock is hardly ever disproved, right? Nobody's ever like... I mean, I guess that's true.
What about the one where he went back to Vulcan and the, like, older Vulcans were like, Spock...
Oh, right. But that's because he wasn't Vulcan enough.
Right.
I thought the paper was going to have some paradox that upset his logic. But you're saying it's a super Vulcan paper that is more Vulcan than Spock's half-breed logic.
I think his humanness, it makes it impossible for him to like fully resolve issues dispassionately.
Maybe he has Ponfar. So he's just thinking about, he's like a horny Spock at the time.
Maybe.
He can't focus on the contents of the paper.
You know, it might be a Romulan thing where the Romulans are like, ha ha ha, we know how to get to Spock.
What's on the paper? They have dirt on Spock.
They do. They have dirt on him or something. I don't know.
They're blackmailing Spock. I need to watch Big Bang Theory more, apparently.
Or, do you, though?
Or indeed at all.
Well, I went looking for instances where Rochambeau... Actually, it was used in real-world situations, drawing lots, not flipping coins.
But literally, three engineers doing a rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah, in order to resolve something serious. And there's an instance that I think is pretty widely reported. In fact, this very topic was recently done by our old partners in crime, Stuff You Should Know.
Oh, Chuck.
Yeah. Chuck, who was the instigator of Omnibus.
That's right. Omnibus would not be here without those guys.
That's right. And so...
So the least we can do is rip off their recent
show.
Well,
you and I have never listened to podcasts, so I can't say that I've heard their version of it. I assume that it just said all the same things that I said.
Ours is better than theirs, but theirs was better than the dollops, but the dollops was better than ours.
Ouch!
It's an intransitive podcast
circle. Dollop!
So what did they say?
But I'm sure they told this story because it's sort of the one instance where something pretty significant happened. And it has a Japanese connection. The Japanese, what is it, a telecom company? Mazpro Denko.
Okay.
They had in their corporate offices a... you know, like an astonishing collection of impressionist art. And at one point, their CEO, Takashi Hashiyama, I wrote these names down, and now I'm saying them pretty successfully, I think.
You nailed that.
Yeah, thank you.
What did Hashiyama-san do?
In 2005, he said, we're going to sell all our impressionist art. We're going to have a big auction. We don't need all these Cezannes around here. And they had Picassos. They had all kinds of things. And the two big auction houses, Christie's and Sotheby's, were in competition to see who was going to get this. And they both made presentations. And I think there are a lot of these. Like in music publishing, there are two big music publishers. There's BMI and there's ASCAP. Okay. And when I was first starting out in music, everybody said, well, you got to pick BMI or ASCAP to represent you in your music publishing. I said, well, which is better? And universally, the advice was they're exactly the same. You just have to pick one. And I went around and surveyed everybody I know, that has...
Because that's not what you want to hear.
I'm like, what do you mean?
No, give me a decision tree here.
And the people that I talked to all had chosen one or the other. There were instances where there were two songwriters in one band, and one of them was ASCAP and one of them was BMI. So they had a real, you know, test case.
They should just assign people.
Which
If your social security number is odd, you're BMI.
And so I picked BMI because it was shorter.
You'd have to write it sometimes.
Yeah, BMI. I've never had to write it once in my life. And this, I think, is the difference between Sotheby's and Christie's. They both do exactly the same thing. They both do it equally well. There was no advantage. And so Hashiyama said, all right, well, we're going to resolve this with Rochambeau.
Did he bring in representatives from both houses?
No, he said each of you houses will have one Rochambeauer, and they're each allowed a second in this in the form of a duel.
Well, I love that he actually had a duel.
And he gave them time to prepare. And Christie's, the head of the art department at Christie's, had 11-year-old twin daughters, and he asked them what to do. And they thought it through and came up with scissors because they said, everyone throws rock, and so these people at Sotheby's are clever enough that they're going to do paper. And the Sotheby's team had no plan.
Oh, really?
They said they
didn't. Sounds like these two auction houses are not exactly parallel. Like, seems like half of them are idiots.
Well, I think that maybe they thought that there wasn't a way to gamify it.
So Christie's has Google. Got it.
And so that is, so the, according to them, they just did it randomly.
What did they throw?
And they threw paper.
Oh.
And so
the daughters were right.
The daughters were right. And it ended up being like a $20 million victory in terms of who wins.
I just realized I have a 50-50 story, although I did not resort to rock, paper, scissors because I didn't have time.
Go ahead.
At the end of the IBM Watson exhibition game where I was playing the computer at Jeopardy.
You're one of the only people, I mean, you're certainly one of the only people in the room that have played an IBM supercomputer in a contest.
That have lost to a computer. Well, I guess maybe nowadays we all have in something, but at the time,
all right,
it was odd to have a computer beat you at your job. Today it's commonplace. There was still one daily double left in the final round, in the double Jeopardy round, and it was pretty clear. There's only one category that was left, I think, and it was clearly in either the third or the fourth row, and I had a 50-50 shot at the other daily double, and I had just doubled up. So if I had done that, I actually had a shot at beating this thing, and I chose, I think, the 600 or the, I don't know, the it was the 1200 clue, and it was actually the 1600 or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I picked the wrong one. Watson got it right, got control back, picked the other one, and that was the daily double. And that was ball game. In hindsight, it turns out we both knew Final Jeopardy, so it would not have mattered. But we didn't know that at the time, given a harder Final Jeopardy question that Watson misses. That could have been like a $1 million swing. It could have stopped AI dead in its tracks. Maybe ChatGPT never would have existed.
Whoa.
If I had just picked the 1200 instead of the 1600.
Do you think futurelings look back and now realize what a turning point that moment was?
That
and
was
they're
it.
Like, oh, we wouldn't be living under the sea. and the world wouldn't have been polluted by human-sucking robots.
That moron had found the daily double.
Yeah.
So there's not statues of me. Like, I'm a hated figure.
Right.
Yeah.
But it was really down to that. Really down to a binary one and zero.
Except that it turned out Watson knew final. So it didn't actually swing history.
I see.
But it could have.
Could have.
You don't know.
Well, the last thing I would note is in your ongoing war against Australia and your long documented hatred of Australian New Zealand culture.
I love Australia and New Zealand.
No, that's not what I hear.
You said culture as if they have any, but I just love the countries.
People send me letters all the time. Why does Ken hate Australia? And the thing is, I know that Australians don't really, most Australians have a sense of humor about themselves. It's only the real nuge Australians that are mad, but they're the ones that listen to Omnibus.
Yeah, all the neurodivergent Australians mm-hmm. are angry at me.
In Australia, they call it scissors, paper, rock.
Really?
Yeah.
Because it's the Southern Hemisphere. Yeah,
that's right. They flip it.
They have to do it in the other order. Do they do the... We should just do it like that.
Yeah.
They do it in the other order. And that concludes Rock, Paper, Scissors. Or, down under, Scissors, Paper, Rock. Probably invented in China. Entry 1079.1CH2613. Certificate number 23611. In the Omnibus.
The good old Omnibus.
Maybe we should. You used to do a randomized podcast. You used to roll a dice to decide what war movie
that's
you were
right.
talking
in
about.
That's right. In our long lamented Friendly Fire podcast, we did every time.
What if you and I, like, at the beginning of a show, we just did rock, paper, scissors, and then whoever wins has to run the show? The topic's already decided.
Wow. The topic's decided, but we don't know. You know, the funny thing about it was we had like a, what was the Friendly Fire die was like a 100-sided die.
Yeah.
And so we kept a...
We keep a list.
We kept a list of 100 movies.
And every time one got used, you just slotted in a different movie to that number.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. That's a good... But you didn't do it in real time, obviously.
We did.
But you'd have to... Oh, but
oh no. We did it for the next episode.
Right. Oh, I see. You did. That makes more sense.
We would choose it at the end of the episode.
Because you've all watched 100 war movies ready to go. Let's see which one we'll do today.
And what it meant was we didn't just do the good war movies
right. That
everybody wanted to see. We were always picking some strange, you know, 1930s Japanese war movie about, you know, their war with somewhere in
Thailand. It makes more sense. Yeah. That's why we do bad shows on Omnibus.
That's right.
We don't want to do all the good shows at once.
No, exactly.
People would have too high expectations.
We would have done Anton LaVey already.
You can find us on social media. I don't know why you would want to do so. The accounts were like at Omnibus Project at one point, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick. I guess I could get Omnibus Project started again at Blue Sky. I don't know. It wouldn't kill me.
Hmm.
What else? I don't know.
You've got some other things to say, don't you?
I'm not really feeling it.
Yeah, okay.
You could, like the ennui overwhelm me before I did the email address. You could write us emails at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You could send us things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. You could find friends. You could look for other listeners online. The word futurelings is your friend if you use it on Facebook or Reddit.
That's right.
You'll find like-minded listeners. There's a Discord now, I think, although I don't remember details. So maybe go to the Facebook page first and use that to find the Discord. It's a real treasure hunt for you. But of course, the real friend is keeping Omnibus alive.
Yay.
And the best way to support the show is at patreon.com/omnibusproject, where I'm not going to lie.
Go ahead.
We're going to ask for a little support, a little financial support.
Not that big of a deal.
It's not. Like, John made $150 playing craps in, like, what, 15 minutes?
Yeah, probably 50 minutes. But there's a lot of standing around, you know. Because you lose, you go down, but then you go up.
But for $5 a month, you could, you get the very best Omnibus benefits. You get early access to the weekly show. It's ad-free. And there's a monthly addenda show, a reader mail show that we enjoy doing. And in fact, you'd have immediate access to 60-something said shows because you're a late adopter.
Yeah.
That's an advantage you have over the really the better, more supportive fans who gave earlier.
I noticed on the Futurelings site that someone was saying that the ads in our show have become like crazy. Do you think that's true? Ads are just flying around. It feels like some kind of robot Darwinism.
They're all for gun shows or something.
So if you're experiencing ads in profusion, I don't know why we're not getting paid for them, but
One, yeah, you may want to choose a different platform.
One solution is to go and give $5 to the Omnibus Project.
$5 a month. So, you know, John's $150 craps windfall would keep you in Omnibus perks for 2.5 years.
See? Wow. Wow.
It's a pretty good deal.
It is a great deal.
So next time you win $150 at the craps table, you know what to do. Patreon.com/Omnibus Project.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. If Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.